That Podcasting presents Home Movie Club, originally recorded October 2017. Episode number 16, Marital Disaster Movie.
Hello and welcome to Home Movie Club, the podcast in which we take an irreverent, and let's face it, sometimes irrelevant look, at the top grossing movies of the last 8-odd years. This time round, we have 1970's Airport, the father of all disaster movies. Joining me to dissect this potential plane crash are Joe Carter.
Hello!
Daisy Swoffer.
Mayday! Mayday! I mean, hi!
And, as always, my lovely wife, Sammy Kelsch.
Please ensure that your seats have been restored to the upright position and that your tray tables have been safely stowed.
Sensible advice. And I am, of course, your host, David Callier. We are looking at Airport 1970, which is... unlike Airport 1973, and then 75, and 1977, and 79, the Concorde one. Yes, it's the first of many, many different airport movies, all following the same rough idea of a plane in distress. But this is, as we said, the father of all disaster movies. Certainly of the disaster movie genre, where you have some very big names, at least at the time, all of big ensemble cast in one particular movie.
Oh, it really was an all-star cast, yeah.
It was, although a lot of the stars have waned somewhat, and I didn't recognise an awful lot of people.
Yeah, but at the time, they were, you know, yeah, it really was like, we're gonna throw all of the actors at this, because this movie is costing us a lot of money to make, so we need to make sure people want to see it.
Yeah.
So let's have some opening thoughts. What did everybody think about this film? Daisy?
I love disaster movies. So I love a lot of the films that came about after this film, you know, like Towering Inferno and Poseidon Adventure. So for me, it was really good to see kind of the film that sparked off all of those. But as a disaster movie, it was very little in the way of disaster movies. So I felt quite disappointed.
Yeah, there was an awful lot of interpersonal relationships as opposed to things going boom. So in many ways, it was not really a disaster movie. It was just a movie where lots of interpersonal politics happened. Oh, and a plane, by the way, has an incident.
Yeah, exactly. A bit like how Titanic was a love story that just happened to be on the Titanic. This was all of these different people's relationships that just so happened to be right when stuff was happening.
Yes, indeed. And Joe?
So I'm not a massive fan of disaster movies, so I wasn't quite sure, well, whether I was going to even enjoy this movie. And I did. I actually enjoyed it. It was pleasant. I really felt for the characters, and okay, I kept on getting all the men mixed up because, let's face it, they all look the same. Yeah, it wasn't half bad.
Good. And Sammy?
Yeah, I also thought it was pretty good. It wasn't exactly what I was expecting in terms of disaster level, but that was fine because as an anxiety person, disasters aren't necessarily my go-to for fun, light entertainment of an evening.
Yes, it was disaster movie light, I think, but also it certainly wasn't a film to watch if you're afraid of flying.
Mm-hmm.
Because it certainly would in no way, shape or form aid in that fear.
God, no.
I have never appreciated security at airports more.
Oh my god.
Yes. Well, I'm sure we'll come onto that shortly, but yes. Yeah. This film is 47 years old and there are some marked differences between how airports and airliners work now than they did then, which shows an awful lot of how things have changed.
Aviation security has come a long way.
Well, oh, there is aviation security for a start, yes. And I think that was a big difference.
Yes.
So it's nighttime. It's a very snowbound Lincoln Airport, which is a fictional airport, but it's pretty much based on O'Hare Airport in Chicago. A Trans-Global Airlines Boeing 707, again, made up. The airline, not the airplane. The airplane certainly exists. Lands on the main runway, runway 29er, but after turning off onto the taxiway too early, it gets stuck in a deep snow and cannot move.
Oops.
Oops, indeed.
See, I thought they were being, when this opened and it was like, the people's names coming up on the screen, there was exciting music, we saw snowplows.
It was very dramatic
and
music,
it was like,
yeah.
Oh, they're really trying to go, ooh, it's snowing and there's planes. And I was like, yeah, I get it, it's snowing and there's planes. And then when the plane landed and hit the snow and I was like, oh, okay, no, that snow is pretty deep. Okay, no, you are entirely justified with the exciting music. I'll let you off.
I did love the opening footage, though, of just some snow plows and some blowing snow, which in itself isn't that dramatic.
But with the exciting music,
you know, it's like...
dramatic music over the shots of people walking to their cars in a snowstorm.
Yep.
It's like, really?
As a Canadian, this is literally just sort of 6 months out of the first 30 years of my life every year.
So having experienced this last year,
the score throughout this music really did like bring in the tension and the drama all the way through. Anytime that you thought you might be like lowering your heart rate a bit, it was like, no, I will up the music again and you will make sure you're paying attention. Oh my god.
Yeah, and anytime it wasn't dramatic music, it was strings and romance, and you know, you knew what you had to feel, because frankly this music was telling you what you had to feel.
Purpose of a good musical score is to
absolutely
underscore the emotional tone of the scene and basically guide you towards how you're supposed to be feeling.
Yes, but the important point in there is underscore, as opposed to, I think at some points in this one, it overscored.
No, that's a fair assessment.
I love the puns.
The plane is now stuck in the snow and its tail is sticking out into the runway.
Oh, heck.
Basically, the controllers have no option but to close the runway and switch all of the traffic to the smaller runway, runway 22.
That control tower, every time we went to it, I was like, this is fascinating. They were all like, all of them were babbling away and, you know, lots of very important and technical things. And everyone was just absolutely cool as a cucumber, not batting an eyelid, just this is the thing and we're getting on with it and we'll sort this out. You know, it was very, very, I loved that. Loved it.
Mm.
The airport scrambles emergency equipment to the stricken airplane as jets start to thunder down runway 22 and out over Meadowood, which is a noise-sensitive suburb situated on the outskirts of the runway, directly in line with runway 22. That's going to come back to haunt them later.
Yeah, those residents are a little bit pissed off.
And we saw
just
why,
They have a lot of tannoy action in this film. And a lot of very...
That's something you haven't said before.
Oh, that's an awesome phrase.
And lots of very old-style pagers that were just things that buzzed when they rang. Our hero, I guess, one of our heroes, it's an ensemble cast, Mel Bakersfeld, which is Burt Lancaster. So one of the names of the film I actually did recognise.
I recognised that one. That was the only one I recognised. But I was like, ooh.
Thank you for noting the character's name, sweetheart, because all throughout I was just referring to them as, like, Burt Lancaster and Dean Martin.
Well, this is it. Putting the notes together for this, I did an awful lot of trying to work out what people's names were, because some of them were only mentioned once.
Yeah.
And then they just assumed you knew who they were.
Yeah, I had to use IMDb to work out character names.
I guess possibly because they were such big name stars that you just assumed that people would go, oh, that's John Smith. So any time forward, if John Smith appears, you know roughly who he is.
Yeah.
Burt Lancaster was the airport's general manager, at this point just on his way out to meet with his socialite wife for an evening dinner do.
He was the one wearing the tux on the phone.
He was, yeah.
He didn't seem very disappointed to be missing out on that night out.
No, indeed not. Again, this will come back to
bite him
be
in
a
the
point later on. Yeah. Mel heads back to his office and changes into snow boots and a thick coat before heading out to the site of the stricken aeroplane. He is interrupted just as he's on his way out by a phone call from his friend, and friend in inverted commas at this point, Tanya Livingstone, who's played by Jean Seberg. Again, never heard of her, but I'm sure she was famous at the time.
She was very famous.
Who is PR manager for Trans Global Airlines. So she works for the airline that has just left its plane in the middle of a runway. She's ringing about coffee, but then when she is told by Mel that there is a stuck 707, she joins him, goes down to the plane to see what happens and also to try and sort of...
mitigate any PR disasters.
Mitigate any PR disasters, yes. It amused me when she said there'd be some $50 complaints for ricked necks, which, again, dates it because $50 isn't an awful lot of money now, but probably back then was a little bit more than that. Although they said at some point they were paying over $400 to a flight to Rome, and that didn't seem overly cheap.
Well, I mean, it was Rome from America. That's quite a long way
actually,
to
actually, yes, this is true. It's a lot further than Rome from Heathrow, isn't
it?
So we'll give them that. He's just about to leave his office and go down when the phone rings again, but he just ignores it and goes out. He meets up with Tanya and they're about to get into their car when he gets another tannoy request to pick up the white phone.
The white phone.
Yeah, so I think it works. The white phone is general and red phone is problem, because they seem to go from red to white quite regularly in this. And they pick up the white phone and it's his wife. And she is not happy.
And especially because he ignored her call. And the first of many split screens.
Yes, they used the split screen and the... I don't know how to describe it for anybody who hasn't seen it, but it's like you almost have circular sections that
like picture in expand picture
into
type.
The screen that have picture in picture. Yeah, and it's done
it's like
really
an
well.
Thing.
It felt very 50s, though, which was a bit odd for a 1970 movie, but it worked.
It was like Mickey Mouse or those old school Disney. I swear they used to have like the little circular thing where there's a character in.
Yeah, it was slightly odd seeing it in a film like this, but it did work.
It worked, yeah. Because then you knew who was talking.
Yeah.
Which was really helpful.
Yeah, it was much better than going back and forth between seeing each of the speaking parties.
Oh, well, then you get dizzy.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we have his wife on the phone and he's complaining, she is complaining that he hasn't come home yet. He explains that there's been an emergency and that he might not be able to make it home. She obviously is, well...
He committed to that over a week ago.
Yeah, he committed to this socialite event a week ago. So.
The snow clearly understood that he was on a schedule.
I can't believe the snow didn't respect that prior booking.
He has to deal with the crisis on runway 29, so tells her he'll call her back. She's not happy about that.
Oh, and he hangs up on her, basically, which is funny. Yeah.
But the fact that she had not responded to that in what we would probably think of as a reasonable way of, yes, you couldn't possibly have predicted this snow, of course you have to stay and sort that out, indicated straight away that they have marital strife.
Oh, absolutely. Well, yes. This was telegraphed as much as the music telegraphed other things. It was like, there was no subtlety there.
Yeah.
So they drive out to the aircraft. Tanya tries to calm the passengers and Mel discusses options with a TGA mechanic. They say, and this is the thing I thought, is what if they just tow the, just stick a truck at the front and tow it out? But they do address this and say actually putting a tow on the front wheel would just rip the front wheels off, which, fair enough. I guess that's something to avoid. So they look at other options. They suggest putting hydraulic bags underneath the wings and lifting it up, but again that would take all of the night and most of the following day, so that's not really convenient because they need the runway clear, because if they don't they can't really keep the airport running. So Mel suggests getting hold of Joe Petroni.
He's an ace mechanic.
Ace mechanic, and actually he is in every single one of these airport films.
By the last one he's an experienced pilot.
Yes.
I'm not sure how that worked.
I was just reading through IDBM on that as well.
Yeah.
And it's like,
yeah.
Joe Petroni, Captain Joe Petroni, flying Concorde. Yeah. It's like,
Well, clearly he knows how to drive a plane.
Yeah.
In this one, though, he is just a chief mechanic for TWA, which is a rival airline on the airport. But he agrees, rather reluctantly, to come and help with moving the plane.
Well, he is the only one who's seemingly in a happy relationship. And he's snuggling with his woman at the time, so yeah.
Yeah, he and his wife are having a quiet date night, having got rid of the five kids at his mother's, and they're looking to have a bit of quiet time together.
Alone time.
But unfortunately, this is not to be because they've got to dig a plane out of a snowbank.
Boo.
But he did agree to come in, so good man.
Yep.
So we then get a scene where Mel and Tanya are back in their car and they're discussing a report from the Snow Clearance Committee, which again is slight, I don't know if these things really exist or what, that is very critical of the way the airport's being handled. And this is just the excuse to bring in the character of Vern, who is Mel's brother-in-law, who blatantly hates him. And it's never really clear why they don't get on. I mean, they're very different personalities, but...
When was it clear that he was his brother-in-law? Oh, I must have not been paying attention to that bit.
He was married to Mel's sister, Sarah, and it was clear that that was his sister.
This is based on a best-selling novel, so I understand there was a lot more detail and depth in the book than we get in the film, so that's probably something that was more fleshed out and relevant in the book.
So yes, they are discussing the fact that Mel's brother-in-law, Vern, just does not like him and will use any excuse to basically stab the knife in to him and the airport, because he does represent the airport. The noise issue over Meadowood has led to a very small protest outside of the airport, which means...
It was very polite as well.
It was very polite and not very big, but it did mean that they got Mel out to the front of the airport, which is when he then met with his sister Sarah, and we got our first actual interaction with Sarah's husband, Vern, who is Dean Martin. I was slightly concerned or confused, rather, why she was actually there. Was it like that she went every time he went to fly away for a couple of days, she went to the airport with him?
I think she was just dropping him off, wasn't she? Like giving him a lift there. And perhaps making sure he was actually going to the airport and not to another woman's house.
Yes, this is true. Whoa. Because they have a brief conversation after Vern has disappeared off.
She is fully aware of his cheating and thinks that it's okay because he'll always just come back to her. And it's like,
oh, no.
Foreshadowing. This is not a healthy relationship in any way,
no,
shape, or form.
Yeah, that's not. That's no.
Once again, we have a rather unhealthy family relationship there. Apparently, the sister is played by Barbara Hale.
She was also a famous actress at the time.
So, yeah, Sarah and Mel discuss Vern and about the fact that he's blatantly unfaithful to Sarah, but she's sure that one day he'll come back to her. Sarah drives off as Mel is called back to work, but Vern simply takes advantage of the time he has before the flight and jumps in a taxi and goes straight round to the apartment of his mistress, Gwen Megan, who is played by Jacqueline Bisset, who I have heard of, so that's one of them, who is the chief stewardess on his flight to Rome. So, yeah, although he goes to their apartment and he wants them to get jiggy with it.
Of course.
They don't really have the time. Yeah, well, that says a lot. But Gwen assures him that they will have 3-day layover in Rome, so they'll have plenty of time.
He really
together.
Tries to pressure her into, you know, yeah. getting on mm-hmm. something beforehand as well. And she's like, yeah. no, just no. And it's like,
no, wait.
The woman said no, just take the answer of no.
And obviously he's just doing lots of banter and that, and she clearly looks like she's trying to pluck up the courage to tell him something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But leaves before they can. So we're back out in the snow and Joe Petone is stuck in traffic after a crashed truck blocks the freeway. Mel reassures him, saying that if he doesn't get moving soon, then Mel will send out a police car to collect him. And then turns to Tanya and says, what else can go wrong?
Oh no.
Famous last words.
Should well not done. Have said that. Should well, not should have said that.
Did not realise no. he was in a disaster movie at that point.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh,
so Mel's about to rush off and get back to the control room when Tanya tells him to stop for a minute and relax, have a coffee, and just let his deputy Mike take control of things for a while. He's been running around for 3 days nonstop, apparently. So.
And is that when she tells him to phone his wife?
Oh, yes. She also reminds him that he said he'd phone his wife back.
And we get the kind of then split screen and the screen wipes showing a montage of arguments just to give us
so
some history to it.
We have a Brady Bunch moment where he calls and speaks to his daughter, then his second daughter, and then speaks to his wife. And then, yes, while they're talking about how their marriage is going down the tubes and everything's going wrong, they do have this montage of you know, scenes where they're arguing and where things aren't particularly, you know, happy at home.
Which is basically the same argument over and over again.
Exactly, because although he was what you were hearing was his telephone conversation, it fitted exactly with what was happening.
It was really quite good.
It was okay, a good well way done. Of giving just this is the where their relationship is at very, very quickly, mm-hmm. while giving some depth to that. I thought that was quite cleverly done.
This is where we see the whole thing of where Cindy's father is a businessman or something. I'm not sure it was ever clear what it is, but they offer him a job that would be steady money and more money and better hours. But Mel's like, no, I'm an airport man. Aviation's my life. This is what I want to do. You've been asking me this question for 15 years and I'm not going to take it up on
it. And it's not like he's in a bad job. He's the manager of the airport.
No, seriously, that's a good job. What the heck?
Yeah.
He was saying, I will look after you in my own way and we'll have the money I provide. And in that shot, you see the oldest daughter storm out and there's a maid in the other room.
Seriously, it's not like
this
suffering.
Is not a family that's struggling with money.
Yeah.
However, I think because the wife is a socialite, it's possibly not enough for her.
Mm.
She wants to sort of inch her way up the slippery slope of the elites of Chicago and he doesn't have the ambition for that. He's more interested in work.
Airport management clearly doesn't come with as much prestige attached to it as whatever nebulous business thing she thinks that he should be doing.
Yeah.
Mm.
So the telephone conversation ends with a very veiled or not particularly veiled threat for divorce from Cindy.
Ooh la la.
Oh no.
Yeah, that wasn't veiled. That was just a threat of divorce, yeah.
Tanya comes back to the office and tells Mel about a stowaway they picked up.
This is the best character ever. Yes.
This whole thread throughout the movie was just so joyous.
Yeah. And the only one of the actors to win an Oscar as well was her. So, yeah.
She was fantastic.
She really was.
Tanya's trying to tell him about the stowaway, but he's not particularly fussed. He's obviously still thinking about what his wife said. And then confides in Tanya that, yeah, it's not that they were fighting. They're just having the same fight over and over again. He confesses his wife might have a point and that he is actually looking for excuses to stay away from home and stay at work.
And then he kind of looks at her in a, you're one of those reasons kind of way.
Yeah. Yes, but again, I think in this actual circumstance with a runway closed and an airplane sticking its tail out into a runway, that's probably a legitimate reason to stay at work.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
But it sounds like that's not always the case.
So Mel's called back to the site of the stuck aircraft where his brother-in-law, Vern, is trying to convince the guys that what they should do is get some hydraulic jacks and lift the plane up. But the argument is, unlike the larger hydraulic bags, jacks would need to be in a precision alignment or the plane would just fall off them and then end up with a hole in the wing and the fuel tank. So
it would be a bit of a disaster.
Yeah, Vern says that's not happening and he's waiting for Petroni to turn up to see what he wants to do.
What was he even doing? Because he's going to be a pilot on an entirely different plane. What was he even doing down there talking about that?
I don't know. I mean, the pilots all stick together and work together and it was the same airline as what he works for. So it wasn't that much of a shot that this guy would go down there to see what's happening.
I was just like, a minute ago he was in the flat with the stewardess and now he's at the plane that's being dug out. What?
Yeah, they didn't have time to get jiggy with it, but he has time to stand around and talk to the other pilots.
Doesn't he like want to leave off that runway? He makes a whole fuss about not being able to depart off that runway and him not being quiet.
Yeah, but he struck me as more the kind of man who is going to sit in a posh lounge and complain about that rather than head down to the plane that's blocking it in the snow.
Yeah, his argument is that he doesn't want to take off on runway 22. He wants to take off on 29. And if they can't get 29 cleared, then if he does have to take off on 22, then he won't put in noise abatement. He'll keep the throttle full powered. So when he flies over the Meadowood area, there will be a lot of noise and a lot of complaints. The guy's a basically.
The guy is a complete.
He is not a particularly nice and moral person.
No, he is.
Oh, that's just so polite of you.
He's a little bit of a naughty man.
We go back into the Transglobal Lounge and Tanya presented with a stowaway by a young and inexperienced airline assistant called Peter Coakley. Stowaway, unlike most.
We'd heard recently about another stowaway that was 16 years old, so it's what our expectations were set at.
We're expecting to be a young, you know, hippie type who just goes off to do things. But actually, no. It's an elderly lady, Miss Ada Quonset.
Oh, and she's just amazing.
Helen Hayes. And as we said, she is she won an Oscar for supporting actress in this role.
She was quite literally the best person in that entire movie.
Absolutely.
In many ways, she was
legend.
Her and the wife of the person we've not got to yet were the two who stood out. And I just think she was the only one in this entire film that realised that actually it was probably going to be quite dry in places. So needed to add sort of comedy elements. Yeah. So she really overplayed it. And it worked really well.
Mm. Oh, there was also the customs guy. He was brilliant.
Yeah.
Ah, yeah. I think his name was.
Anyway, he was just amazing.
We'll get to him in a minute,
amazing. Yeah.
She is introduced to Mrs. Quonset, who confesses to regularly stowing away on airlines.
I wrote in my notes about how is that even possible? And then I wrote, oh, she explains how.
Yeah, so she treats it as some sort of game. She's spinning tales about her late husband and her daughter in faraway cities, etc. It wouldn't be possible now, but obviously this is another thing that is, it's the early 1970s, well, I guess.
And she was wily.
Mm-hmm. And she was very cunning. Mm,
yeah.
Mel drops into the office to see where Petroni is, and he's then introduced himself to Mrs. Quonset. He tries to impress on her that what she's doing is wrong. She doesn't care. She knows what she's doing is bad, but she also knows that if found out, it'll be an absolute disaster PR-wise.
Yeah.
Prosecute an elderly lady just trying to, you know, visit her daughter. We don't even know if this daughter even exists.
Yeah.
I think she does. That part rang true.
She does actually then tell them the many ways she gets on board planes without a ticket. And they say just one of the things that ages this film because, you know, nowadays you wouldn't get anywhere near any of it without a ticket.
It just seems so impossible that this is something that you could actually ever do.
I loved it. She was taking the things out of her bag to be like, oh yeah, and I do use this and it's getting taken off her by Livingston. Yeah. She's just like, no, let me take that off you then. Thank you. I'll just take that too. Thank you.
And then the last one she sort of gets out and she puts away.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, to an extent, for obviously people who haven't seen this film, the security you would expect now if you're getting on a coach service from London to Edinburgh. So, you know, you'd have your ticket checked probably once and you'd put your bags away and that would be it. Seems to be the exact same level of security they had in the airports back in the 70s.
Yeah.
It was, I would say, a different time. It's a completely different time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we saw this to an extent when we watched The French Connection, when they had them just writing in their own tickets.
Yeah.
She tells them how she manages to get on board and Tanya says that she'll be stuck on the next flight back to LA. But until then, she's going to be accompanied by Peter Coakley.
Oh, bless him.
The young, naive.
Yeah, he just had the look of naivety, didn't he? One look at him and it was like, it's not going to take a long to get past him.
No, Even I could probably get past him. He was just like...
he was so gullible.
Yeah.
Mrs. Quonset and Peter leave, and whilst they're alone, Mel confesses to Tanya that the real reason he stays works as much as to spend time with her.
And he says he doesn't know what to do about it
because he doesn't love his wife, but he doesn't want to break the marriage up because that seems like a failure and he doesn't like to fail. But before they can discuss it more, Tanya's called down to the customs area by the chief of security.
Because she's transferring.
Yes, she's talking about transferring to San Francisco, and it's all like, what we're going to do?
Yeah, it's now or never.
And so it's never, and we never speak of it again.
Okay.
So Chief of Security Henry Standish, who is played by Lloyd Nolan.
Is that the customs guy?
That is the customs
guy. He's
awesome,
yay.
Yeah.
He's very good.
He is epic.
Reminding me a lot of a cross between Burgess Meredith and DeForest Kelly. But the sort of that almost southern charm, but wily and knows what's going on. So this chief of security has asked her to come down because he has stopped an elderly lady who is complaining that he's being overly intrusive when in actual fact she's smuggling diamonds and fake fur coats and real fur coats and God knows what else.
Without paying a customs fee.
Without paying any customs fee, which is why she's doing it and has... As the chief says, it'll actually cost her 10 times more in fines than it would do just for the customs fees.
So that sets him up as being a very perceptive man who just instantly knows when people are trying to get something past him.
He's been doing the security lock for 30 years. He knows he's seen it all before.
But it was just really epic. It was like, the stitching is terrible. And then it's like, oh, what's wrong with you, little dog? And she's like, no, it's okay. Sorry, I made a mistake.
Oh, your collar a bit tight here. Let me undo that. Oh, look.
It takes the little dog's collar off and, oh, look, there's some diamonds.
It was just like,
But then he goes on and tells Tanya that he's got a niece on the flight to Rome, asks if Tanya can swing a window seat for him, which obviously she says yes for. But it also means that obviously he's now got a reason to worry about this flight as well. So it's all kind of stacking up in a sort of kind of house of cards kind of way that could fall down in one easy way. And also he asks, with the weather, will the flight leave on time? Which is, I thought, was a very good transition because it went from that to the same question being asked of the TGA info desk by our main antagonist, who is D.O. Guerrero, who's played by Van Heffling.
That was his last
Again, never
film,
heard of him, but he was.
I kept on reading that as Van Helsing,
right?
Yeah.
I read it as Van Halen.
Which made me giggle.
When I first saw it, I assumed his name was, you know, John Van Heffling. But actually, no, his first name is Van. Yeah. At least his acting name is. It may not be his real name. So he asks whether the flight will fly on time. They tell him he will, and he goes back into his quite seedy apartment to finish packing his attaché case, which contains 3 sticks of dynamite, a big battery, and a trigger mechanism.
Bomb! It's a bomb, bomb!
Bomb! Bomb. It's a bomb, but also...
recognise a bomb when I see one. That's a bomb. Guy's got a bomb.
It just goes to show there's no security for things like hand luggage at this point.
Yep.
Yeah.
Because they worry about checking stuff when they get to the other end or when they land here.
But all they're worried about checking is customs things, not actually, checking for security issues.
So yes, he has this attaché case that is basically a homemade bomb. He then goes down to see his wife, Inez, who's played by Maureen Stapleton.
Yes, she was brilliant in this.
Yes.
She was one of the highlights of this film. Her and Mrs. Quonset were by far the best ones in it.
Mm-hmm.
She's working in a late night cafe. He talks to her, assures her that everything will be fine, that he's got a plan and he knows what he's doing. He's got a job in Milwaukee and they'll be all fine and he'll have lots of money. She doesn't really believe him. I think she's heard this all before, but she's just like, look, just try and keep this job now, because he keeps losing jobs due to arguing with 4 men and things like that, because he is a demolitions person.
Although, notably, his last job he lost because some explosives went missing.
Yeah, so we don't find that at all later, but yes.
Mm. Then it's like, if he hadn't have taken the explosives, he wouldn't have lost his job and he wouldn't need the explosives. So why did he take the explosives?
Yeah, I don't know. You're probably best not to...
Maybe you saw the writing on the wall and that was just an excuse to fire
him. Yeah, perhaps he had other arguments and he already knew that his job was going... This wasn't the first job he'd lost.
Yeah.
So he takes the... He tells his wife he's taking the bus to Milwaukee, but actually takes the bus to the airport. However, the bus is also stuck in traffic.
That confused me as well, but I... Yeah.
Well, I was confused on this because they were talking about this being a transfer bus from the other terminal, but... He got on it. So I don't know whether we missed a bus ride out. So he got on a bus to the airport and then got a transfer from the other terminal. We didn't see that. But they were holding up the flight because the ground transport hadn't turned up yet because it was stuck in traffic. I can't see them doing that if it's just a bus to the airport that's just a general bus.
Yeah, and later on we saw that there's a passenger manifest for that bus as well.
So I think what it was, and this wasn't particularly clear... was that he got on a bus to the airport and then got on a transfer from one terminal to another, and it was that got stuck.
Right.
At least that's how I read it. It's the only way I can see it making sense. Otherwise, why would they... Because they delay the flight by an hour because this transfer bus hadn't turned up. And I don't even think in the 70s when this was done that they would do that just for a bus. So Petroni finally turns up in a police car, meets up with Mel, and they head out to runway 29er. Whilst in the background, the crew of the Rome flight head out to their plane. Petroni chides the workforce for, slacking, and promises Mel that he'll have the plane cleared by midnight. Mel then heads up to the boardroom to speak with the airport commissioner, Commissioner Ackerman. Again, I have no idea who that is, whether that was a famous actor or not. I didn't recognise him, and I didn't even write his name down.
I can't remember.
So and Ackerman tells him that the Meadowwood residents have said that unless the flight stopped by midnight, they will sue them for damages worth $10 million, which, even though they probably wouldn't win it, would still be a PR nightmare for the airport.
Quite.
So the deadline is now pretty much you have to get that cleared by midnight.
But then he starts going on a whole kind of, what we need to do is actually massively improve the airport, and we've got all these plans. For what? Yeah. It's like there's actually more immediate problems, but I didn't appreciate the way that the commissioner actually said that to him. Save it for your women's clubs and Rotary lunches.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a valid concern that airports did have that point because they were bringing in the 747, which is a much bigger airport.
Yeah.
It can take, 500 odd passengers in a single hall. And lots of airports had to do an awful lot of work to get themselves up to spec to actually even take the plane.
Mm.
And as the 747 became ubiquitous with pretty much every airline, if you didn't do that, you were going to be in trouble. So, I can see where that came from, but it did seem quite shoehorned in.
I think it was probably in the book, it was probably there in a more natural way, and they just wanted to kind of address that point a little bit in the film, and so it kind of got shoehorned in here, and it felt a bit like, what? No, he would be surely focusing on the immediate
issue. This doesn't seem to be the immediate issue, so they argue about closing the airport down for the night, which Mel refuses to do. But Ackerman said he'll then consult with the rest of the commissioners and he'll get the decision about the fate of the airport to Mel within the hour. We go back and Inez Guerrero returns home from her shift at the diner to find a special delivery has been left. It's a letter with a refund for an overcharged ticket to Rome on tonight's flight.
He's not gone to Milwaukee at all.
She thinks that he is going to Milwaukee, but apparently he's got a flight to Rome. I think at this point sort of confusion turns to worry. She starts to realise what her plan of her husband's actually is, because he's been saying about he's got an idea, everything will be all right.
Yeah, I think she starts running through all the stuff that he was saying, and
So she calls the airliner for information about the flight, but they can't confirm whether her husband is actually on the flight, and encourages her to go to the airport to see if she can catch up with her husband before he boards the plane, because the plane's been delayed by an hour.
Because so encouraging travel in heavy snow conditions is a great thing to do.
Yep, smart.
We then get our first view of the inside of this lovely orange 707.
I loved this. I loved the seat covers and the stewardess outfits. I really liked that stylizing of this.
I'm not sure it was stylizing. I think that was just the style of the time.
They were designed specifically for this film, and they did actually come under quite a bit of criticism for being matronly, the stewardess outfits, and I didn't think
really?
They were matronly
they were nice.
At all.
I thought they were cute.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
They were really cute.
Yeah, so I really liked them.
So we're on the pre-boarded flight, so we've got no one on there apart from Gwen and Fern, and this is where she confides in him that she is indeed pregnant, and he is indeed the father.
But she doesn't expect anything more from him. Like,
no.
She's not saying, so you have to leave your wife or anything. She's like, I understand that you're married and that's
Yeah,
not-
so like, I was careless. I stopped taking the pill because it was making me fat. So instead of being plump, I'm now pregnant.
Yep.
Which
I thought that was a brilliant line.
Yeah.
And then he generously offers to pay for an abortion in Sweden, where they do it well, apparently.
She's not convinced by the idea of an abortion, oddly enough.
So therefore, adoption is the only answer.
Yep, so they look at adoption, but again, if they adopt, then she will never see the baby, and
I really
they don't really
like
ever make to a decision,
an
though.
Option of she has the baby.
Yeah, there isn't really any decision made, because before they could talk much more, the rest of the crew get onto the flight and they make some excuse about broken
broken air conditioner. We weren't talking about what we're going to do with our unborn child. It's fine.
No one knows about this blatantly obvious affair we're having.
Nope.
Back at the stranded airplane, crew are trying to use the engines to move the airplane out of the snow, but the TGA pilot refuses to use full power. Petroni argues that the plane can take the strain, but they now have to dig deeper and put planks of wood under the wheels to get the plane moving again.
I got excited because it moved and it went about 2 feet.
It moved a bit,
and then it stopped again. Yeah. It's like, did you forget to dig out further than 2 feet in front of the wheels?
Because of the strain on the aeroplane, the pilot refuses, but Mel pulls rank and orders Petroni to do it, much to the disgust of the pilot. But then he's the one who drove into a snowfield, so I don't think he's got a lot to say on the matter.
So then the pilots leave, so it's not on them. Like, fair.
Fair enough. The bus transfer finally makes it to the terminal. And they've not even pulled up to the terminal before they're like, the flight can now board.
So before this point is when I got bored. I got bored and I had to stop and I had to carry on watching it today. And I was like, I'm just going to, quickly tell my husband what's happened so far in my movie before I quit this and go to bed. And I was like, there's snow at an airport and a plane's stuck and men cheat on women. That's all that's happened in like an hour into the film.
It's kind of a funny movie because a lot of things are happening and yet not a lot is happening.
Yeah, as soon as I came to summarize it, I was like, the biggest thing that's happened really is men cheating on women. Yeah.
But I felt, we were about an hour in and I kind of felt like, wait a second. And then I realized that it's quite similarly to the way that Titanic is structured, in as much as there's this massive lead in before you actually get the, you know, sort of meat of the something bad is happening.
Yeah.
The in inverted commas, disaster.
There's like two thirds of it is set up for that at least.
Yeah. So I was like, I'm feeling tired now, so I'm just going to carry on with this tomorrow when maybe there'll be less men cheating on women.
Yeah.
So the terminal bus turns up. They put over the tannoy that the flight to Rome is ready to fly. And this is overheard by our favourite, Mrs. Quonset, who spins another tale of wanting to go to Rome with her late husband. I mean, I don't know how much of this is true and how much of it is not. She's a consummate con man, so it could be utter rubbish.
I assume everything that comes out of her is lies. She's a fantastic confidence trickster. Is her real name Mrs. Ada Quonset? Is she really a little old lady? Who knows?
She heard Rome on the tannoy and she just went,
she's actually
tale about Rome.
Squirrels in a coat with a hat.
Yes.
Yep, she is a squirrel with a coat with a hat.
Exactly.
She decides that, actually, I'm going to fly to Rome. So she starts feigning an illness, obviously taking full advantage of Peter's naivety.
It's the most fake way possible. It was really obvious.
She's so full of crap.
Yeah.
Wonderful. And he just,
she's amazing.
And he just buys it hook, line, and sinker, and she knew he was going
to.
She makes her way to the ladies' room. He rushes off to get a doctor, and as soon as he's out of sight, she, miraculously recovers. and then just wanders off into the crowd.
She goes to find where the Rome flight is leaving from.
But as she wanders past, she actually passes Guerrero, who's purchasing flight insurance from the airport.
Yeah, I was like, so they sell, like, life insurance at the airport? That doesn't give you a lot of faith in the flights, does it?
I did read that actually in the book there is a conversation between Mel and one of the other characters that this is a bad idea and they shouldn't be doing this in an airport, but I think it did happen. So
that's terrifying. Yeah. That would have just made me just turn around and walk back out the airport.
What's more is that he bought $225,000 worth of insurance for $7.50.
Yeah.
It's like, really? So he takes the insurance, he pays in very small change, puts it in an envelope and posts it back to his wife, Inez, although at this point she is actually already in a taxi on the way to the airport. Tanya and Harry Standish, who is the chief of security, and I keep saying that and thinking Worf, but I don't mean Worf.
No.
Harry Standish going for a coffee, but Tanya stops off at the desk, check on the Rome flight. Guerrero passes Standish and offers him his ticket. Standish explains that he's just waiting for someone who doesn't take the ticket, but gets suspicious of Guerrero's furtive nature.
And the fact that he's, like, hugging his attaché case.
He tells Tanya that he thinks Guerrero's smuggling, but Tanya says that if it's the case, then the customs in Rome will get him. Because at this point, if he is smuggling, he's not broken the law because he's not left US soil. Mrs. Quonset, meanwhile, is hiding in a call booth, watching the last of the passengers checking into the flight to Rome. At the last minute, she rushes up and interrupts the clerk, telling him that, she's found her son's wallet that he's just dropped. And he's just got on the plane, so she tries to offer the wallet to the clerk, but she knows he can't take it, and he directs us to one of the stewardesses. However, they're all busy, so he uses their discretion to covertly sneak onto the plane and hide in the washrooms until the doors are all sealed.
I loved all the little times that she was peering out the toilet door. I look closer.
But when she was just peering up against the glass, and it was just this is amazing.
Yeah, she was great.
I really did love her. She was awesome.
I mean, I don't think they even unlock the toilets until you've taken off nowadays, but that might be why. Perhaps they all saw this film and went, probably should do something about that. So yes, she's managed to make her way onto the plane, waits till the doors are closed, at which point she makes her way into the cabin and randomly sits on the middle seat between a random passenger and dun-dun-dun!
Guerrero
himself.
Bomb guy. On the same flight as pregnant stewardess and womanizing pilot.
And niece of security guard. Everybody's going to Rome. Rome must be great.
Yeah, everyone wants to go to Rome that night.
Oh, because it's snowing.
Yeah.
Well, true. I quite like
Yeah,
snow,
they did
though.
Say on the flight the weather in Rome is a lot better than where you've just left from.
Yes, I suppose Chicago being the windy city, it's also very cold as well. So
windy
be,
city is a mighty pretty, but it ain't got what we got. No.
What's that? Rain and sleet and terrible, terrible traffic.
Oh, it's from Calamity Jane.
Okay. Inez Guerrero reaches the airport just as the plane is departing.
Yeah, that was poor timing.
Tanya go back to office and is told by Peter that Mrs. Quonset's got away. Shocking nobody.
He looks so sheepish.
Back on the plane, they realise their headcount is wrong and are investigating, but pilots want to get away because they have a window in the air traffic control, and so they insist that the count is abandoned and they fly off. And they get to this just before Mrs. Quonset is asked for a non-existent
ticket.
Yeah,
literally, the passenger
Very convenient.
Before her, yeah.
That was just hilarious.
Flight taxis away from the terminal just as Innes reaches the gate. She goes and speaks to the supervisor, who confirms that her husband did get on the flight. Worriedly, she just watches the plane depart before sitting down, distraught.
Was there some? She was I feel very, like there was some dramatic this. Music here. Was there some dramatic music
there was
here?
Definitely some dramatic music here, yes.
Yeah, she's really just in a state of shock at that point then, isn't she?
Yeah. I think she knows what's happening. And
yeah, she's processing everything she knows. And the fact that he deals with explosives and what that means for all those innocent people that have just got on that plane. Yeah. She must know that he's doing that for her as well.
Yeah.
And putting that onto her. Oh, what must be going through her head at that point?
I know.
Yeah.
I just sort of expected her to say something sooner, but I don't know.
Yeah. I guess shock as well. Plane taxis and takes off as Guerrero clutches nervously at his case. Back at the airport, Tanya confirms that, yes, Mrs. Quonset was on the Rome flight. So they call up to the plane to verify. Gwen is sent down, check the passengers, confirms that, yes, she's there.
What was really odd to see 23B. About this time was when Bomb Guy, he just lights up a cigarette on the flight.
Oh, there was so much smoking.
Oh,
yeah.
My God.
Even the co-pilot.
Yeah. Like, yeah. The pilot smoking.
And it's
the
just
pilot's
like,
there smoking
oh,
a pipe.
That just looks so weird and wrong.
Yes.
Like,
they've got pure oxygen in there. Why are they smoking, the
I
fools?
I know.
Because they're allowed to. This is the 70s. Through this entire movie, everybody is smoking.
Oh, I know. It's that doesn't make it any nicer.
No, not at all. Tanya's still worried about Standish's report on Guerrero, so investigates further. She realizes that he was one of the last to get on the plane because he ran into her, or rather ran into Stanish as they were all leaving. So realizes that he must have been on the transport bus that was stuck. So she calls down and gets a list of names from the driver for all the men on the bus, which seemed quite astute, to be honest. Mm. She's good at her job.
Yeah.
Mel then gets a call to say that his wife is waiting for him in his office, so he reluctantly goes to see her.
Yeah, it's like, God damn it, I've got a crisis, and
just
you want
to
argue about this bloody dinner party.
So he's off to do that. Tanya is stopped by a security guard who introduces her to Innes, who has picked up wandering the airport in distress. She doesn't have any money to get back into town. And the security guard's logic is, since the husband took a flight on a TGA flight, that perhaps Tanya can help. However, Tanya realises that Guerrero is one of the names on the list, and this indeed may be the wife of the man she's looking for. We then switch back to Mel and his wife Cindy, who are in his office arguing.
Divorce time! Yay!
Divorce time! Yeah, so Mel is told that his oldest daughter has left, run away from the house, although apparently only gone to a friend's house, so yeah. And she'll be back tomorrow, so not that much of a running away.
Yeah, that sounded a lot more dramatic when she first said it.
Yeah, it was the most polite running away you could have, I think.
Quite.
Yes. Oh, yes, she's gone to a friend's house. I've spoken to her. She's fine.
Yeah.
It's not running away.
Run
That's
away.
Just...
No, she's just gone around a mate.
Run away!
Yeah, running away makes it sound a lot more dramatic than just, you know, well, she's...
But I did like the, she's like, when he was saying, you know, oh, but it's a broken home, blah, 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 with kind of arguing against divorce, and she's like, it's better to come from a broken home than be in one. Like, yes.
Yeah, so because he's arguing that they need to sort themselves out for the sake of the children, and Cindy's saying, well, no, to be honest, it's the only option is to be divorced. And then Mel agrees after Cindy admits to having an affair.
Oh, yeah, she's totally cheating on him. Did you not know?
No, like, did you not pick up on that?
He obviously
like,
didn't
Where
know.
Did this come from? Why is it suddenly his fault?
But I did appreciate finally that there was a woman cheating on a man.
Yes.
Yeah.
Equal opportunity cheating.
Yes,
it was good.
Exactly.
But their conversation is interrupted by telephone, and whilst Mel is preoccupied,
bloody telephones.
Cindy just slips away.
Telephones, yeah.
Tanya tries to get Mel to speak to Innes, but Innes has disappeared. Tanya rounds up security while Mel speaks to the insurance desk, who confirm that Guerrero did indeed buy insurance for the flight.
Yeah, she's done good detective work there by finding out about the insurance policy. Really, really super obvious taking out the insurance just before getting on the flight, though. Like, that was really poor planning on his part.
Yeah. This convinces the airport management that there is a good chance that he has a bomb and he is going to blow the aeroplane up over the ocean. Mainly because that would mean no evidence of foul play and the insurance would pay out to his wife. Yeah.
Hmm.
Well, not smart because he's about to blow himself in a plane up.
Yes, stupid strategy. Terrible idea. Don't do it.
I do like the way he's using his little map of the routes and he's drawing along where the plane is at the time all the way.
That is rather cool.
Waiting to see when they get over the ocean. Back on the plane, Vern and Gwen talk. Vern admits that he loves her.
God, what a bunch of saps we are.
Would he have admitted that if she wasn't pregnant?
Well, I was being sarcastic, but yeah.
And he wants to do the right thing.
Yeah.
But the right thing for him or for everybody else, he's not actually saying at this
point. That's because he was talking to the other pilot and he was like, yeah, I've got 7 kids. 4 of them were planned. And I was like, who volunteers that information when they've not been asked?
Well, they were friends, weren't they?
Yeah.
They were friends and they were talking about how
he'd managed to... How many kids do you have? You don't go, I've got 7, 4 of them were planned.
Oh, that part. Oh, right, yeah.
By the way, you know, like Eleanor and, you know, Darren and Rachel were mistakes, but...
exactly.
You know, please don't tell them that they were, you know, an accident. Yeah. You know, I just take all of that back. We love all of our children equally.
If he'd have said, and were any of them unplanned, I could totally understand him saying that. But he just volunteered that information straight off the bat. You know, 7 kids, yeah, 4 of them were planned, 3 of them weren't. Oh, okay.
And it was kind of the whole, and we never thought about getting them aborted because they've turned into wonderful people.
Yeah, I did feel like that pilot was brought to us by the pro-life movement.
Yeah,
seriously.
So finally, the security guards find Inez and Tanya and Mel speak to her about her husband. She explains Greer was a demolitions expert and he's unable to hold down jobs. They were both broke and desperate. That he'd paid for the flight by pawning her mother's wedding ring, despite her asking him not to do that.
Yeah, but there was one bit in it that made me feel uncomfortable, was the whole, you know, he was mentally ill. And that was obviously a reason why he was going to blow up himself and a plane full of people. It's like, you know, so that made me sad because, you know.
But it was probably poor, you know, treatment of his illness that had led to his series of not doing very well in jobs that had led him to such desperate
that
measures.
That was what was implied. And also he was in an institution after his stint in the army. So it was potentially an army-run institution, which... in the 60s and 70s, possibly wasn't that.
And if it was something like PTSD, and then you're dealing in demolition and explosives, like, I can see that being a bad combination.
That's not a good combination.
But it was just the way that it was like, oh, yeah, well, obviously he's mentally disturbed, therefore he must have a bomb and want to blow. And I thought
treated poorly in films and media and things. So sadly, that wasn't a surprise for 1970. And it's a shame that we haven't come quite as far as we should have by 2017.
But I just wanted to call it out as a...
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it's perfectly valid.
Quite
obviously, as it's very close to, you know... my heart.
The information is related to the airplane, whilst the airport team discuss options for the plane if the bomb does go off.
They give us a really detailed description of what would happen if the bomb goes off.
Which is fine, because the actual special effects later on didn't really match up to that. So.
I had to rewind and went, oh, I thought I'd missed. No, I didn't miss anything. Okay, cool. Because I thought I must have missed something because I was making tea at the time.
Petroni goes on about the fact that if he is in his seat, it'll only blow out the skin of the airplane, so it won't be as bad. But they will suffer from serious decompression and oxygen starvation. That is assuming the plane survives the explosion. But because he's in a window seat, it's going to be less of an issue than if he was in an aisle seat, which I guess would probably blow the entire tail off.
Yeah, they didn't tell us why.
No, they didn't.
And it's not like it's we true. Understand how planes are put together to know what that difference would be.
Also, they didn't know how much dynamite he had, so how on earth are they going to estimate the, true. You know, the power of the explosion?
Yeah, that's a very good point.
Yeah, and I hadn't thought of that, but that is true. He could have, you know, half a stick or something. He could have nothing more than a couple of
there was a lot of extra
bangers or
there
something.
Was a lot of extra space in that attaché case. He could have had a lot more sticks of dynamite in there.
Yeah, which would have been a lot more deadly.
Because they assumed basically he wanted to blow a hole in the plane and blow himself out.
I think they knew he wanted to blow the plane up. So they relay this to the plane. It begins to slowly turn back towards the airport, descending to a lower altitude.
Turning very slowly and descending very,
very slowly, so people don't notice, although the little annoying kid did
really
notice.
Really loudly as well.
Yeah.
Oh, but luckily the dude didn't hear, but that was quite cool because the pilot didn't just fob him off and say, oh, no, we're not turning. He gave him like this really comprehensive, detailed reasoning.
Utter false reasoning,
yes,
but never
yes.
mind.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you know... Well, yes, but he did it really well because if he'd have just said, oh, no, the kid would have made a fuss.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And
yeah.
He just handled that really, really well.
I was
actually, you know.
Yeah. It was great.
Yep, so he's gone back, he spoke to the child, but he also goes back to confirm that Guerrero is there and then asks Gwen to go and speak to Mrs. Quonset about her ticket.
Oh, this bit was really quite well done.
Yeah, because then I was like, okay, so they've worked out that that's the guy and he's got a bomb in his case, the case he's hugging. How are they going to do anything about this?
They can't. They did say they couldn't grab the case because he was on the aisle.
They couldn't lean over.
Row.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was like, what? How are they going to deal with this? And this is, then we find out how they're going to deal with this.
I thought that was brilliant. Absolutely
Gwen goes down
brilliant.
And confronts Mrs. Quonset and pretty much physically drags her up to the flight deck.
Well, because they had to make it look realistic.
Well, it was realistic.
And obviously for
well.
Quonset, she thought it was realistic, so... but they get to the flight deck and actually what they're doing is they're to ask her to help.
Offering her a first class ticket as well.
Yeah, first class ticket and all the charges drop.
Yeah.
So she agrees to do this, goes back to her seat. Well, again, gets manhandled back by Gwen and starts to make a scene. Gwen slaps her. I don't know if that's appropriate action in the 70s.
Oh, she was great at doing the hysterical passenger thing, though, wasn't she? She's like, you want me to do that? I can do that. Yeah.
And then it just went a bit Pete Tong after that.
Mm-hmm.
So she grabs onto Guerrero, basically in defense, but what it's actually doing is getting him to let go of the case, which he does. Gwen grabs the case, but then the other passenger who's been annoying the entire flight thinks, they're trying to steal his case, grabs it back off Gwen and hands it back to Guerrero, who's now panicking.
You can't take his property, snatch. No, that's the bomb.
Guerrero's got the case. He's backing away towards the back of the plane. Vern tries to talk him down, but then another passenger comes out of the washrooms behind him. Which
was so frustrating because he was just about to hand him the case.
Yeah. Yeah, but then if they handed in the case and the bomb didn't go off, it would be less of a disaster movie.
It was just really tense. And I was like on the edge of my seat. And that's that, because I watched that bit twice, because obviously, as I said, I had to rewind to see what actually happened.
Yeah.
So at this point, Guerrero knows that his insurance is not going to pay out because everyone knows about what his plot is. So he's got absolutely zero reason to explode that bomb now.
Well, no, except that he's going to get charged and life in prison and family and all that. So he's just I've got nothing to live for now.
I guess they were just trying to talk
him
down.
So the guy comes out of the washroom. Guerrero runs into the washroom and locks himself in the washroom, which again, I don't think you can lock a washroom from the inside without it being accessible from the outside nowadays. But just as Gwen's banging on the door trying to get in, he explodes the bomb, which puts a hole in the side of the plane.
Gwen!
Yeah, that was what... But it was just like, he closed the door and then suddenly thwomp. It was really tricky.
But at least he did it from the toilet so no one else got sucked out.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, that was...
So Gwen gets a toilet door in the face. She goes down and then the entire airplane starts to decompress.
The cups and stuff are going out of the window. That was
apparently
kind of funny.
This is one of the few rare occasions of a movie where a plane decompresses and there's not lots of papers flying around for no apparent reason. Because you always seem to get papers flying and no one had papers until then. It's slightly weird. So yes, the bomb's gone off. There's a hole in the side of the fuselage. The oxygen masks all drop from the ceiling. Everybody starts huffing oxygen. But yes, Gwen is now pretty much unconscious. Has managed to not be sucked out by the aeroplane, despite being very close to the hole, but has now passed out.
I'm not surprised. She got splinters in her eye.
The initial panic subsides on the flight as blankets and assistance are handed around. However, an ominous crack in the ceiling forms.
The crew were pretty good, weren't they, with the, you know, getting all the oxygen masks on everyone and dishing out the blankets. And, like, they were, you know, like, I know they've been trained in this, but they were on it. They were doing well.
Total if you're in a situation like that, you'd have to hope that the staff were that good.
Yeah. Like, the guy who'd gone completely blue in the face, he got his oxygen on then. That was all sorted. They're all fine.
So the pilots declare an emergency, oddly enough. But the only available landing fields are Detroit and Lincoln, where they left from. Although Detroit is heavily snowed in and has, like, 5 inches of snow over ice, which is not ideal. So they decide they're going to try back for Lincoln, although the longer runway at Lincoln is still blocked. And they need a longer runway. They can't land on 2-2 now because they've got damage to the plane itself.
Yes, so they've got a reason rather than just being pissy about it.
Doctor reports back to the flight deck on Gwen's condition with serious injuries to her right eye. And at this point, Vernon tells her that she's pregnant, whereas the rest of the flight crew give him knowing looks.
pregnant, is she? Yeah, yes. You know about that, do you?
Nudge, wink, wink.
Woo. Mel now knows the runway needs to be cleared no matter what, so orders the snowplows to break from runway clearing, and if need be, they can just push the plane out of their way, regardless of the damage it
will cause. I love the dramatic snowplow arrival. I've never seen such a dramatic snowplow arrival before. It was epic.
Dramatic music.
This army of snowplows just lining up there. It was great. I loved it.
Yeah, Petroni sees the plows and asks for another 15 minutes, but then Tanya tells Mel the decision on the runway will need to be made before that because the plane is getting close.
The control tower person designated to this gets told they're the person. All their other stuff's being taken off them, so they light up a cigarette.
Yep, that's right. Get ready for it. Petroni's on the flight deck and gets the stuck plane's engines up and running and tries to move the plane as the clock ticks down and the damaged Rome flight limps back to Lincoln Airport. Petroni eases the throttles up as the plane inches forward through the snow. Inches and inches, however, he has to throttle back down and Mel decides that he's going to have to send in the snowplows.
Send in the snowplows! Send them in now!
But Petroni refuses to give up and pushes the throttles fully open.
But the snowplows are coming in and I'm like, forward. Are the snowplows going to get burnt by the jet engines? Seriously!
Well, this was a slightly weird thing is they had all of the engines on full. And yet the snow on the ground around them wasn't really being disturbed.
Or melting.
Yeah, we should probably be not that critical of this film from the 70s, but yeah, it did seem a bit unrealistic at that point.
Yeah, I haven't been in that position behind a jet engine, but I understand they're hot.
And indeed, Mythbusters showed that they also put an awful lot of wind out the back as well. Mm. The throttles are pinned fully open. The plane shudders, but it shudders forward and clears the snowbank and back onto solid taxiway, clearing the runway.
Petroni did his stuff. He got it going. Yay. He is the man. He's the ace mechanic.
Rome flight makes its way down to runway 29er. Turbulence on approach feeds the panic in the passengers and some of the viewers, i.e. me. I hate landing in aeroplanes. I was getting quite stressed at this point. So the runway's cleared, the plane's down, it manages to safely land and stop, just avoiding hitting the end of the runway, despite the extra length of runway 29er. So yes, if they had landed on 2-2, it would have crashed.
Into the barrier.
It was like the Krypton factor when they were coming in, it was great.
Yep, it was down a bit, up a bit, left a bit, right a bit.
But the snow was lights, there was no way they could have landed without that guy. It was.
Yeah, they were using precision
radar. That's why the guy lit up
a
cigarette because he was focused. He was on it. Oh yeah, got the cigarette.
Yeah, that was just incredible directing there. That was, you know, like
that's why.
Video
that's why they
game
took the other
epic.
Planes off him, so he was only dealing with that one plane because it was all on him.
I don't think there'd be many other planes landing at that point, though.
But that's
fair.
What they said. They were taking his other planes off him. So
they land, manage to pull up safely. Vern rushes to the back to speak to Gwen. assuring her that things will be all right.
Everyone's alive except the one guy who blew himself up. And I'm like, what? Yeah. I thought it was going to burst into flames. The back was going to fall off. They're all going to die.
Yeah, I was so expecting the tail to fall off.
I was expecting
to fall off. They land on an island.
Took place in this film. And that's not a complaint because I'm happy that everyone, for the most part, lived happily ever after. I realize Inez is probably going to be in like counseling over this for about a million years.
But how, after all that ominous cracking, did the tail not fall off? I was quite disappointed.
I was really disappointed. I wanted more deaths, damn it.
I suspect the tail didn't fall off due to budgetary constraints.
I think that's probably true.
Yeah, but it was like foreshadowing, but no actual bang.
Yeah. They just wanted us to be tense and anxious about it.
Yeah, I think it was more a sort of like slow burning stress movie than disaster.
Yes.
If we're going to genre categorize it more accurately at this point.
Yeah.
I think
it was
more
a drama.
Sort of mounting stress than it is just a major disaster.
So the plane's down and the stairs for the aeroplane get drawn up and the passengers start to disembark.
And there's press everywhere at the airport.
Press everywhere because someone got hold of one of the...
The transmissions.
One of the
transmissions.
Mayday ones, yeah.
And also that meant that Sarah, who's Vern's wife, manages to find out about this and gets to the airport to greet her husband.
He's very anxious and worried.
Poor thing.
Seeing the injuries and devastation, Inez Guerrero rushes to the passengers as apologising for her husband's actions.
But no, I thought she was also looking for her husband.
I think she was initially looking, but then realised that wasn't going to happen because of what's happened.
Yeah. Okay, that's fair enough. That seemed like maybe she was looking.
She's seen by Tanya, who holds her as she cries in remorse.
Because it's not her fault!
No, but she's obviously feeling guilty because he did it for her.
Oh, God, she's
that still doesn't make it
for...
her fault.
No, it's not.
No.
But she's
I don't think anybody was blaming her, but yeah.
I would feel guilt about it, though, you know, if that was me.
So a doctor from the flight, because apparently there was three doctors on this flight, thankfully.
Luckily.
Meets up with a local hospital doctor and reports on Gwen's situation. Sarah overhears that she's injured, but also that Gwen is pregnant. Gwen is wheeled out in a stretcher and Vern goes with her to the hospital, not even looking in Sarah's direction.
She has that kind of hopeful anticipation and then that kind of dawning realization. And then when she sees him go off with her, then it's just resignation. And she goes through all of these emotions without saying anything, but she communicates this so well to the audience.
Yes, I put it down as Sarah deflates knowing her marriage is over. Morning breaks, hurrah, which is more than we said for the back of the plane. And the damaged plane is being inspected. The hole in its fuselage measured and recorded. And it's not the biggest hole in the world.
I wasn't sure why we even had this bit, to be honest. From this point on, it was like, is the film not finished at that point?
I think this is just sort of wrapping everything up, isn't it? So they're all going on about how they have to send a thank you letter to Mr. Boeing for building a solid aeroplane.
That was kind of cute.
Petroni goes off with his box of cigars that has been promised to get the thing moved. And then they have lovely Mrs. Quonset getting the VIP treatment and a first-class ticket back to New York.
And
she's with Peter and confides that actually it's much more fun the other
Bakersfeld
way.
Bakersfeld is going to go off with Livingstone to sample her scrambled eggs, which I'm going to use
as a
euphemism.
Oh, yeah, that was so
now.
Cheesy.
It's now my official euphemism, sampling her scrambled eggs.
Not going back for coffee or to see someone's, you know, etchings. It's now to sample scrambled eggs.
Sample her scrambled
eggs. Which apparently are delightful.
Mm.
Wow.
Yep. So they're going off back to her apartment. An airport employee runs up with a problem. It's one of the big snow blowers that Mel's assistant Mike wants Mel to look at. Mel tells him to tell Mike to take care of it himself.
Which is good.
Smiles,
you know.
And drives off with Tanya. Because he's obviously showing that he is now learning not to be so responsible because he knows that his life is different.
Well, when his choice isn't work or his wife, and instead it's work or this woman he's actually very interested in, he's making a very different choice.
And now he's going to be working with this woman for the rest. Well, no, she might. I don't think she'll be going to San Francisco now, which means that he'll be stuck working with her. And there are certain thoughts that you should not work with your other half.
Quite.
And that's the end. Body count one.
Disaster movie.
Big stencil,
body count
big stencil
one.
Font at the end saying Amazing. The end.
Body count one. I mean, really? Body count one. I'm so upset about this.
That's not our lowest by any stretch, because our lowest is definitely zero. Uh-huh. But it's certainly...
This was billed as a disaster movie to me.
It's probably the lowest one for any disaster movie,
body count
yes.
One.
Disaster movies today are seen as a sort of film where anybody and everybody could die.
Yeah.
You don't know whether your favourite actor is going to survive more than the first scene. And in many cases, they don't.
Yep.
But in this one, because it was like the prototype for the disaster movie, only one person
died.
But
even because I wasn't even setting my expectations to modern disaster movies. I was setting my expectations to Towering Inferno, Poseidon Adventure, films I love that came very shortly after this. Mm. And they have more than body count one.
I wonder if the body counts are higher in Airport 73, 74, 75, 79, 87, etc.
I don't know. And I think potentially the body count's higher in Airplane than my airport.
Speaking of, how many times did I have to mentally correct myself that we were doing Airport and not Airplane for this podcast before we watched
42.
The movie?
Yeah,
it's got to be. It's
got
to be.
That's what
well
I thought we were doing
40s.
As well until we actually got close to the time. And then it was like, oh, hang on. No, Airport. Oh.
Yeah, Airport obviously far more successful because it's on the list where unfortunately Airplane isn't.
I'll be honest with you, I enjoyed this movie.
Airplane was still very successful, though.
I was really looking forward to getting to watch Airplane.
You can still watch it, just not for the podcast.
Airplane has survived longer in the sort of social zeitgeist than Airport did, possibly because it was a comedy and obviously there's more memorable action / comedy / things happening in Airplane
movie.
Than Airport, but.
It came out in 1980, which was just kind of just the disaster movies that were so big in the 70s, kind of sparked off by this one, were starting to perform poorly at the box office, kind of the late 70s, and then Airplane just kind of, it turned everything that those movies were into obvious tropes, and it kind of killed off the genre at that point. It was quite a while till we started having disaster movies again after, and it because Airplane just went, yeah, that's it's just silly, don't do those anymore.
Yeah, I mean, that's only Airport 79, which I think was the Concorde one, and that is the one where Petrelli suddenly an experienced pilot. I don't think that was particularly successful, so perhaps this is not a huge surprise. So yes, that was 1970s Airport.
I have a fun fact.
Oh, good.
Ooh, cool one.
I have a fun fact, and this is courtesy of Paul. Hi, Paul. So the aircraft used in the film was on hire, and it later crashed on takeoff while on lease to an airline.
Yes, I think it was destroyed in Brazil or something like that, if memory serves.
It was on the March the 21st, 1989 in Sao Paulo, in fact, yes. Well, on its landing approach, it crashed.
I mean, I'm not sure that's really a fun fact, because I think everybody on board at that point died, although it was being used as a cargo plane, so it was less people on it, but it was 8 or so people, and then people on the ground died.
Interesting fact, but not necessarily fun.
Okay. Yes.
Interestingly, not fun, but Lancaster said that this movie was the worst piece of junk ever made. And he only made this film so that a studio would finance a few lower grossing films that he could star in.
Oh, well, you can't always tell, can you?
You know, he could have phoned it in and he didn't.
So, final thoughts, and we will mess this up again and go with Sammy first.
I enjoyed it, I think, more than I thought that I was going to, because I was kind of expecting a just constant stream of, oh no, everything's bad, running around sort of screaming at each other kind of disaster. But this was more of a character piece with mounting tension than that. That was nice, and I think the thing that I enjoyed the most about it was Helen Hayes' wonderful confidence trickster old lady and just the amount of ridiculous chutzpah that she expresses in this movie. I loved her so much.
Yep, absolutely.
Agreed.
Joe?
Yeah, as I said at the beginning, it was unexpected how much I actually enjoyed this movie. And yeah, the best part was the old lady stowaway. Between her and the customs security guy, I was surprised how much I actually engaged with the characters and sort of like really felt like
you know, I had a bit of a stake in the film. And yeah, though, to be fair, I was very sad that the tail didn't fall off. But I guess that would have been too much special effects.
Yeah, I mean, I felt that I hadn't seen it, I don't think, before. Certainly, I don't remember ever seeing it. I think anything I had seen had been sort of the memories of it had been corrupted by Airplane. And it was an awful lot slower than I expected it to be. And it was a little bit boring in places to me. But actually, no, I enjoyed it. And it was really not what I was expecting. But yeah, no, I think it was good. And I can see why it was popular, because it was probably quite different at its time as well. As you said, the special effects were a little bit shonky in places, but then it was 1970, so maybe that's not a complete surprise. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and actually I would recommend it if anybody likes sort of a fairly slow but enjoyable Sunday afternoon movie. I think this would be perfect for that.
Yeah, I would recommend it too, which is, you know, for an older film, I think it holds up quite well.
And finally, Daisy, your thoughts?
I appreciated this movie as being kind of the start of disaster movie popularity that I do love. But I do like more disaster in my disaster movies. Interestingly, I watched the trailer after I watched the movie. And the trailer was very strongly emphasizing the very popular book that this was based on. It also showed you the entire plot of the whole movie, literally everything.
It was such a comprehensive trailer.
Yeah,
like, just yeah, because we watched afterwards as well.
I liked the way that it showed us how it had these seven stories intertwined. And I was like, yeah, that's why there was so much other stuff. There was these seven different stories going on. No wonder they used an all-star cast, because you had to be engaged in every one of those stories.
So many plot threads, yeah.
And actually, yeah, it was at that point that I realised they weren't really trying to be a disaster movie. It wasn't really a big thing then. They were trying to be a character movie that had this disaster or potential disaster in there as well. And I appreciated a bit more once I got that perspective on things. Though I did like their final lines of, for crisis authenticity, airport has no equal. For mounting tension, airport has no equal. For sheer fingernail biting suspense, airport has no equal. I loved it.
It's fantastic, really fantastic.
If it's on YouTube, and I'm not sure it is, then it's certainly worth hunting down that trailer, because it is. It's
although,
quite fantastic.
If you don't want to have the entire plot of the movie shown to you in the trailer, then don't watch it, because it really does show you everything.
To be fair, if you don't want the entire plot of this film shown,
like,
then
this off. Wipe your memory.
Too late.
Do it now.
Yeah, you now know what's going to happen.
Our entire podcast is a spoiler warning.
Every episode of this podcast contains spoilers.
So, yes, that was 1970s Airport. And next time around, we are going for another film with an A in it. We are going for Aladdin, which was 1992, Disney's animated classic.
Slightly tenuous connection there, honey.
It's a very tenuous connection, but it does start with an A. And there's flying things in it, so, you know.
Actually, that's a good connection. I'll accept that.
There's another connection.
Mm-hmm.
Neither this film nor Aladdin have semen in them.
Whoa. That's unprecedented.
So
for
we
this
haven't
podcast,
got through a whole
two
podcast.
Films in a row with no semen.
And on that bombshell, I would like to thank my fellow podcasters for joining me on this review of the 1970s top grossing film Airport. I'd like to thank Daisy.
Thank you too.
I'd like to thank Sammy.
I'd like to thank you also.
And I'd like to thank Joe.
Joe here, represented by giggles.
Indeed.
I can't speak for laughing.
I'm sorry.
And I'd like to thank you all for listening. My name's David Callier, and we'll see you in 2 weeks' time for Aladdin. Until then,
bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye, and thank you for listening. And any new listeners, welcome. And hopefully you were entertained. And if you made it to the end, then congratulations.
Well done.
If you did like what you've heard, then give us a like, give us a review on iTunes.
Send us
your tweet and tell your friends. The details will be at the end of the podcast. Until next time, goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Home Movie Club. part of the That Podcast Thing Network. Find us on Twitter at @podcast_thing and on Facebook by searching for That Podcast Thing. Please like and subscribe for news of our future episodes coming soon.